gaming on the mobile platform has been less than a resounding success to date. However, the potential of a huge existing network of users in this channel keeps game developers coming back, trying to capitalize on its potential. Principal analyst Paul Jackson covers gaming for Forrester, and in this presentation at the company's Consumer Forum on October 25th, he reviews the history of gaming on the platform, the downside and upside of mobile when it comes to games, and the future of mobile in the overall gaming market.
Mobile gaming. Part of my gaming remit, which I cover globally for Forrester. More specifically, typically, the console and PC space, but obviously the gaming side has a lot more potential, 80, 90% of people having some form of mobile handset. And of course, as with the theme for the overall conference, really wanting to look, particularly in the closing stages, around how mobile gaming has a real sort of social computing element. So, I came to Forrester about 6 years ago, and at the time, I was doing a lot of stuff about early broadband and mobile adoption, but I've been a passionate gamer for years and years and years, more of a collector of gaming equipment than a very good player, but I've always liked these kind of things. So, in 2001, I started to say to Forrester, I'd be really interested in doing some coverage around video gaming. At the time, to be honest, Forrester was kind of gaming. What does, that's just for kids, isn't it? Surely it can't be very interesting to our clients. And now, of course, 4 or 5 years later, we see people like EA, Microsoft, who, strangely enough, wasn't actually in the gaming space aside from Microsoft Flight Simulator 5 years ago, 6 years ago, spending an awful lot of money to capture those young hearts and minds with gaming experiences. And as you'll see from some of these stats, a very, very big global business. So just in way of overview, I'm going to look at the global video gaming industry in general, and some of the devices associated with that, and play models, and types of gamer. Look specifically at mobile gaming, which has been with us in one form or another for a good 5 or 6 years, and has had ludicrous predictions in terms of the size of that market for at least that long. And then move on to finally my own ludicrous predictions about how big the market's going to be in the future based on the improvements in the gaming and also some of the social computing elements. Okay, the business of video gaming. It's a huge industry, particularly in the US, Japan and the UK, the three leading markets for gaming globally. Last year, NPD, who track in-source store sales, they pegged the US gaming industry being about $10.5 billion. This is everything. This is software sales for PC and console, accessories and consoles, plus mobile, although they're not really counting that in yet. It's not a big enough industry. PC game software alone was worth around just under $1 billion last year. The biggest success there was the online games, World of Warcraft, things like that, which interestingly was the first time that a successful game was digitally distributed. You know, we've talked a lot today about digital distribution of content. World of Warcraft was really one of the first successful titles which went out over the wire rather than being pressed to a disc, put in a box and put on a shelf. Globally, the market, which isn't an NPD figure, I would estimate around $25 billion a year. As I said, the Japanese market, the South Korean market for PC games and mobile games, and the European market almost being as big again as the US market. So this is a very, very big industry. An off-quote statistic is that the US games industry is bigger than cinema, movies. And what they actually mean is it's bigger than box office takings rather than the takings of a movie, because that would be much bigger. So it wouldn't be as impressive a statement. You're also seeing that there are a lot of big, big companies either dedicated to this space or playing in this space as well as a bunch of others. Microsoft, obviously, with its Xbox brand, is the key example of that company that is outside of gaming and has a massive gaming spend as well. Bandai Namco, of course, also formerly just Bandai, had a lot of toys and things like that. So these companies here probably make up cumulatively a good 70 to 80% of that revenue that you saw on the previous page. Varies hugely by market, obviously, but it breaks down into the platform owners like Nintendo, Sony, Microsoft, and the software developers and publishers who are the other guys you see here. And it's something which is spread across multiple platforms. As more and more devices have got decent screens, decent user interfaces, good amounts of storage, and network connectivity, you've found that games have been one of the first things that have spread onto these type of devices. This is from a report I published earlier in the year, and sort of uses a four-box model, of course, basically looking at the portability of gaming versus whether it's a general purpose device or a pure gaming device. So you see all the games consoles down the bottom right-hand corner, all the sort of portable games consoles like the PSP, the Nintendo DS, top left-hand corner. But interestingly, the more widespread devices, general purpose devices like PCs, mobile phones, over this side. Motorola Razr there, V3 being the key example of at the time, a state-of-the-art phone. So what you gain in terms of dedicated gamingness, you lose in terms of install base. There are biggest install base over there is the PlayStation 2, of which they've sold about 110 million units globally over 5 years. So some of those don't work anymore. So there's 90 million PlayStation 2s out there. Other things like the GBA, over the course of 15 years, has sold an awful lot more than that. But again, only a fraction are still in use. Compare that to PCs, where we've sold over a billion PCs globally, and mobile phones, where you're seeing more than 50, 60% of the population have a mobile phone. Who plays games? Depends on what kind of games you're talking about. Console gamers, usually young, affluent, male, playing genres of games, which are racing games, fighting games, FPS, first-person shooters, going around, looking down the barrel of a gun, effectively. Typically, that tends to level out in the early 20s, 20-year-old males, post-students, things like that, and trail off from then on in. Offline PC games, typified by things like the original version of The Sims, or even card games, Bridge, Solitaire, typically older, skewing to the general PC-owning population. MMORPGs, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, World of Warcraft, EverQuest, all those good games. Pretty similar, in fact, to the console owners. Typically putting 30 hours a week into these games, so basically it has to be somebody who's young, doesn't have a full-time job, and it doesn't matter if they stay up all night, a couple of nights a week, to play these kind of games. But they are paying usually quite healthy subscription fees, 10, 15 bucks a month, to play these games. You only ever play one at a time, obviously, given the amount of time you're putting into it. And interestingly, I'll come back to this one later, the casual gaming market, which is the people who are using GameTap or playing games on Yahoo Games or on Reels, Real Game, Real Arcade Portal. Interestingly, the only gaming demographic that tends to skew to be more female, older, some sites say average age mid-30s, and a strong homemaker contingent, people playing these games during the day for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. These are not gambling games, incidentally, these are just games of skill, poker, chess, backgammon, Bejeweled Deluxe, if you've ever played that, Zuma, things like that. That's by far the biggest growth potential market, because obviously you look at the players today, and potentially that is already a much bigger market than young affluent males who have 25 hours a week to spend in a game. Overall, from our last survey, around 21% of 16 plus consumers in the US play some form of games in their spare time. Over a fifth of consumers play games. And that ranges from, you know, maybe an hour a week playing solitaire right the way up to that massively multiplayer gaming or playing on consoles every evening. So it's by no means a niche activity anymore. That was the upside. Let's look at mobile gaming now. In many ways, mobile gaming seems like the next logical conclusion of gaming. You know, you have a very rapid turnaround of devices. Your device is replaced every 18 months, 13 months, 2 years. They're very capable devices these days, very powerful. They skew to a lot of those groups that you saw that play games, young, affluent, male, students, things like that. The hardware is low cost, in many cases completely free. That's very similar to the console model, where for every Xbox 360 Microsoft sells, they lose about $100 and make that up in subsequent software sales. And phones are by definition networked, so you should be able to get some of that social computing play straight out of the box. None of this waiting for broadband to be connected or looking for Wi-Fi hotspots. Indeed, Nokia will tell anybody who cares to ask that they probably have the most played game ever. By the middle of last year, 350 million copies of this game had been distributed. And for many consumers, it's their first and only mobile phone game. What game is it? Snake. That one, yeah. Basically, it was on every mobile handset that Nokia made for 10 years, hence the 350 million copies. It is the one that people who've played around with their phone during the first month or so have played classically. Changing now because there's a lot more sophisticated games being on the phones. Nokia, drunk on its own success, thought, wow, surely there's a dedicated market for a games phone. The N-Gage. This is actually the second edition, the QD, which is actually not a bad phone. It's great for texting because you can hold it sideways and use the cursor at the same time as the keypad. The other key thing that this did that most mobile phones don't do and is vital to gaming is allows you to press two buttons at the same time. Classic problem with mobile games, particularly action games, is you want to go left and shoot. You can't do that because you can only go left and then shoot rather than doing it at the same time. The N-Gage fixed that, but unfortunately has significant issues, mainly publicity related, around the ludicrous way you had to use the first edition to make calls. You had to hold it like this. The microphone was in the edge. I mean, admittedly, it came with a headset, and you could use the headset. But basically, it looked incredibly stupid and just wasn't a good experience as a phone either, because you can imagine there's a lot of air there between your mouth and the mic, so you're getting a lot of interference. It also led to the internet phenomenon, obviously, of people holding other things to the side of their head and publishing the pictures on Flickr. That's an actual N-Gage, but increasingly it became any other gaming platform, holding it to the side of your head and making out that it was funny. So it was an unmitigated disaster as a hardware platform. There are actually some quite okay games on it. And as I say, as an actual phone for texting, it was quite good. But it showed a couple of things. One, that even young consumers were not ready to sacrifice some of that photo capability for a phone that was slightly better at games. And secondly, Nokia's thesis that if they provided games on chips, memory cards, that would be far easier for people to go into a store and buy than downloading things off the network, also proved not to be true. So that was our first foray into dedicated gaming handsets in the mobile space. There have been a bunch of other issues. This is the dip in the story before we close on a high. Game publishers typically reckon they have up to 2 months after a new handset's been bought to sell people a game. This is when people have got their new handset, they're setting up their ringtones, they think, oh yeah, I'll try a game, and they'll download it. After that period, if they haven't downloaded a game, most publishers think, no chance, I'll have to wait till they buy their next handset. And mainly that's because the quality of the games is so appalling. The other quite scary stat is even gamers who do download a game very rarely download another game. So it's the one game, you download Mortal Kombat, which you've played on the Super Nintendo 10 years ago for your phone, you think, this is going to be great. And it's appalling. It's unbelievably poor. And you think, man, I paid I paid $8 for that or $10 for that. And it's dreadful. You know, it's not even playable because I can only press one button at once. Add to that the fact that most gamers who play on consoles or PCs don't even consider the phone as a gaming platform for the reasons above. You know, the games are dreadful and they don't work very well on the handheld. And these people are more into playing 1 or 2 hours of gaming rather than the casual 5 or 10 minutes which mobile gaming suits. From the developer side, it's not all roses either. Because of the proliferation of different handsets, any one game you want to release has to be compiled for 100 or 200 different handsets. Bearing in mind the resolution of the screen, the form factor of the screen, how the keypad's laid out. So you have to customize every game in this way to get to the maximum number of potential consumers. And finally, the industry did itself no favors with a bunch of fairly dubious business practices, as you've seen in the ringtone market as well, such as people think they've downloaded a free game, but in fact they've actually joined a subscription service which will bill them a couple of euros each month. And then they make it very difficult for you to cancel that subscription service. And you know, after 6 months you find out, wow, I've paid 25 euros for this game, which was I played for 10 minutes and was rubbish. But people don't typically scrutinize their mobile phone bill in that much depth, particularly when a lot of the billing was done via reverse SMS, which they already had quite a lot of SMSs on their bill anyway, so it's actually quite difficult to distinguish what was for the mobile game. So, the upside. What we're now getting to is a point, after all these learning examples, whereby the handsets are all color, typically, they all have pretty good speakers in them or good headsets with them. The keypads in general are better and sometimes offer multiple key presses. And the processor in the actual phone is well capable of delivering some of the high quality graphics and gaming that you would expect from most gaming platforms. And also, a lot of these phones now have enough storage to store 5 or 10 games without running out of space. Whereas in the old days, if you downloaded one game, should you wish to download another game, you couldn't do that without deleting the first one. And believe it or not, at the forefront of this is the N-Gage, again, from Nokia. What they've done is they've learnt from their hardware-based trials, and they've said, okay, fine, people aren't going to buy a dedicated gaming phone, but we've now built a lot of experience of developing games for phones, and the N-Gage phone was not specifically designed. It was a standard Series 60 Nokia phone, fairly mid-range at the time. So what they're doing now is they're moving to downloading games for the N-Series phones, which are their media phones. That's the N80. But they also do one which is got a 5-megapixel Carl Zeiss lens for taking pictures, and they do some MP3 player phones as well. They're high-end phones, $200, $300, $400, $500 without a subscription discount, but they are bound to be more successful than the N-Gage because they are just the top-range Nokia phones. They're not dedicated to gaming, they're multimedia computers, as Nokia insists on calling them, slightly annoyingly. It also uses Snap online technology, which was part of Sega that Nokia bought 2 or 3 years ago. And these guys basically built the online service for the Dreamcast, which was Sega's last physical console before they were beaten out of the business by effectively by Nintendo and Sony. And they bought this part of Sega and basically built it into a gaming hub. The N-Gage Arena is based off this technology. And it does something which a lot of current mobile games don't do, which is allows you to play head-to-head across the mobile network without too much lag. Lag is the killer in mobile games. There's no point playing a shooting game if I shoot you and by the time that message gets through, the person's in the next room. It's fine for battleships, for chess, for cards, but it's no good for action games. Snap tends to get around a lot of these issues by some very clever application of algorithms. You're also seeing that, unlike the first range of video games on phones, which were developed by startups, admittedly startups like Jamdat, which EA bought. You're now seeing the mainstream publishers from the global video gaming world that we saw up at the start of the presentation getting interested in this. EA has announced that it will manufacture or at least publish a number of games for the N-Gage for download, a direct payment. And Taito, who are another Japanese gaming company, are bringing a bunch of their retro games to the platform. They did Bubble Bobble and a bunch of those games you may have played in the arcades in the 80s if you had a sort of delinquent upbringing that I had. We're also seeing that this increase in power of mobile platforms and ability to deliver games to consumers is coinciding with the explosion of the casual gaming market. If you saw some of the figures predicting the size of the mobile gaming market 3 or 4 years ago, they're dwarfed by some of the predictions of how big the casual gaming market will be 2 or 3 years from hence. It's quite a difficult market to define, but effectively it's games that anybody can play and would typically want to play for 5 or 10 minutes at a time. So it's not something where you have to, you know, take your elf character and go on a 4-hour quest through the woods, not World of Warcraft. Did anybody see the South Park World of Warcraft episode, incidentally? That was fantastic. Except on the blogs, like an hour later, everybody's complaining about, oh, well, Cartman claimed to be a level 15 tank, and yet he was able to wield the Sword of 1,000 Truths, and that's quite clearly not possible in World of Warcraft. It's not those guys. It's the people who want to play Tetris or Snake or Bubble Bobble or, Zuma or Bejeweled Deluxe. The online leaders in this world are people like PopCap, who are develop Bejeweled Deluxe, Zuma, and a bunch of other highly, highly addictive games. These are the kind of games that give you RSI, basically, because Bejeweled, if you start playing it, you can get up to about the 30th level, and it's just kind of, you know, your hand turns into a claw afterwards on the PC. And the other people that are doing this are Real Arcade, Yahoo Games, a bunch of people are developing these for specific devices as well. Of course, Mr. Jobs announced a couple of weeks ago that the video iPod will also be able to play some of these games. And as you can see, that is Bejeweled Deluxe, again, from PopCap, which is available for download now onto the video iPod. These are great levelers, these games. And they're not something that require a huge amount of coordination or skill. They're puzzle games. They're things which anybody can play and can play for short periods of time. And most people will either play them for free for 20 minutes and then say, this is good enough to buy, or we'll have some sort of advertising supported model whereby BMW allows you to play this for another free 10 minutes if you watch a BMW ad. There's a company called Wild Tangent who are doing a lot of interesting ad supported models in that way, well worth checking out. So that's why it's so interesting and why it works particularly well on a mobile phone as opposed to online, because let's remember, everybody who's got on a PC with an internet browser expects all their content to be free. Apple maybe has cracked that with iTunes, gets people to pay for music sometimes, but typically everything else should be free. And certainly with casual games, you can skip from those 20-minute free demos on game after game after game and play for years without paying anything. But with a phone, you've got a whole bunch of secure payment mechanisms and already this connection to the network by default, which you don't necessarily have with your PC. The three most popular are premium SMS, as I mentioned before. You send an SMS to a company and they bill you $5 for it. But for that $5, you're allowed to download the game. Direct billing, you add it to your phone bill. Or micropayments, you have some fictional currency. Acorns was the one I mentioned yesterday, which is Cyworld in South Korea. Microsoft has Microsoft Points in the Xbox world, which allows you to download the game. There are also a bunch of business models in play. I mentioned all of these, actually. Advertising supported typically works very well for casual games. And this varies from, you know, versions of Bejeweled Deluxe. I had a fantastic one, which is versions of Bejeweled Deluxe, where they changed the diamonds and the circles and the moons into tennis balls, swimming trunks, and roller skates. And it was sponsored by Always, because these are the things you could still do if you use the Always product, targeted fairly unusually at the young female market. So that's blatant sort of brand promotion to the more subtle things like, you know, this 20 minutes of this game is brought to you by BMW. Subscription models are okay. They don't work as well in the casual market as you would expect because it is just that 5 or 10 minute play. But there are services, for instance, that Namco runs whereby you can pay $5 a month and for that you're allowed to play 4 different games during that month. And they'll add some more next month and you can pick 4 of those games as well. And pay-per-play, so you download it, you play it for an hour, and then it expires. So how does social computing fit into this? Well, some of it's fairly obvious in that mobile gaming it fits very well with the mobile's primary function, which is communication, peer-to-peer communication and interaction. Mobile phones are much more social technology than PCs. You also see that a lot of these games draw on mobile's facets in terms of instant messaging, the presence that you're exhibiting within the game or to your friends, and matchmaking like Nokia's Snap technology, which says, well, you know, he loves playing Auto Modelista, but he's actually a really rubbish driver. I'm not going to put him up against somebody who's a really good driver because that's not going to be fun for either the rubbish driver or the good driver. I'll pair 2 good drivers to each other or 2 rubbish drivers to each other. So at least there's a challenge there. And again, mobile networks are very good at tying those things together because you have the critical mass of players. Interestingly, in the whole casual gaming space, we see increasingly that the games are used to facilitate conversations. So, you know, and this is typical in the sort of teenage boy market where, you know, you don't really want to call somebody up and say, hey, what are you doing? I'm sitting here, you know. But what you say is, you know, you'll text them and say, hey, want a quick bout of Final Fantasy? Excellent, log on. And then you can chat either on audio or via text while you're playing the game. So the game's really just a construction that you can interact through. And where does this go next? This is where it starts to get really interesting. You have your World of Warcraft gnome sitting on your PC. But whenever you're not at the PC, nothing happens. Your character doesn't develop. The world carries on, because the interesting thing about many of these multiplayer games is they're what's known as persistent universes. So they don't actually live on your PC or your console. They live on a server somewhere. When you disconnect, the world carries on. But what you see increasingly is that you will be able to take your character between platforms. You will be able to play on the PC the full game in full 3D, design your characters, name your horses, whatever, and then you'd be able to also tap into that game on the console, which will be a more immediate game playing experience because you don't have a keyboard, you don't have a mouse, you don't want to be managing assets on the console, you just want to be in there fighting. And then you can also, during the day, if assuming you have a day job or a life, you can actually check in on what's happening in the world via your mobile phone. So, you know, I'm a gold miner, obviously, as you can tell from my stature. I bought a gold mine. I did that on the PC, set up my account and everything on the PC, and I've been playing and mining from the console for a long time. I've put some gold up for sale in the gaming world, and I want to see how the bids are going on that. I can check in on that on my mobile phone, or I can coordinate with other players as to when they're going to be in the gaming space as well. And the big advantages here is it's a bit like what we've been talking about with the TV world, is that the best possible experience is going to be on the PC. You know, the richest graphics, the best sound, the best communication, the best user interface, to be honest. The most immediate or accessible experience is going to be on the console. But the experience that you want here and now, wherever you are, is going to be on the phone. Combining those into a compelling gaming world, if you can do that, you're going to get more of those people who can't dedicate 30 hours a week to sitting in front of their PC to play these games. Also, this technology is very transferable. It doesn't need to be games. It could be ordering video clips, ordering music clips to be delivered to your PC or your console from your phone. And the people that are doing this, it's a company called FrogHop, who are in the Bay Area, a very young company, and they are basically building servers which allow you to interact between these channels and pretty much the examples you get, they give, if you talk to them, are just that. You know, the asset management and coordination with your friends via mobile or other channels. And the other people who are looking at this in a great deal of detail are Microsoft with their Live Anywhere service, which was announced this year at E3 in May, and is still, as is the FrogHop service, pretty much on the drawing board, more aspirational than reality. But they have a couple of games like Forza Motorsports 2, where you're going to be able to do this. You're going to be able to play the game on the Xbox. If you want to design your own car or paint job for the car or buy a new paint job for the car, you can do that on the PC. And then during the day, you can check the lead tables of lap times on your phone and coordinate with maybe the people who you think are roughly in your same kind of skill level to meet up and play at a certain time later. It's tremendously sticky, and it both extends the value of a specific game. And basically, of course, for a lot of these publishers, the bottom line is, how can I get beyond selling people a game once every 3 months, or in the case of mobile phones, one game for the lifetime of that handset, and get them to maybe possibly pay slightly less for that initial game, but then to keep coming back and buying small items or a subscription from me and keep playing that game for a year or 2 years. Maybe supported by putting some adverts into that game as well, which is a whole different session, so I won't go too much into that. So, in summary, mobile gaming has been a disappointment, actually, it's probably an understatement, for a bunch of those mobile game developers who have been putting those games out there, and they've been selling 10, 20, 30 copies of these games, despite the fact that, you know, of all those reasons we saw, the mobile is a pretty good platform for gaming. And the reason is that most of the developers didn't use the social computing or network facilities of a phone. They just saw it as, you know, once you've got the game onto the phone, it's just like a Game Boy. It's not the point. It's never going to be the point of a phone, in the same way that mobile TV is never going to be as good an experience on a phone as it is on a console or a PC or a TV. What it's about is, it's with you all the time and it's always networked. So use that facet for tapping into the status of your games rather than trying to create something which mimics dedicated hardware. But as I sort of hinted throughout the presentation, things are changing fairly significantly. The handsets are certainly powerful enough now for good quality games and do allow that multiple key press. The network support multiplayer. There was an interesting period whereby you could play online, but you couldn't actually play against anybody. What you could do was sort of record your track time, and then that would be uploaded, and then somebody would race against a ghost of your car, which is a halfway house, and got rid of around some of those lag issues that were predominant. But now you're actually seeing true global head-to-head play because the mobile network's got a lot better. And the social computing applications here are fairly clear. You know, it's facilitating conversations. It's key for sort of, you know, developing user-generated content and building in those social networks and avatars of consumers. Okay. Thanks very much for your time.